97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
It's so damn hot. Milk was a bad choice.
Yeah, I'm no fan of Dave Murray's right now. He was on live about an hour ago with an updated forecast, and you know he just referred to that cool front, which is not very cool for Sunday. And then Monday, I don't think Labor Day is too bad. It's like 91. That's okay. But then next week, we go back into the oven again. So that's the part I don't like about Dave Murray. I should say I don't like his forecast. Of course, we love Dave here as our chief meteorologist, but not really something that is unusual at the end of summer in St. Louis, and it's one more weekend for the pool, so it's good pool weekend. Coming up a little later in this hour, my friend Dan Buffett. Dan writes and talks about entertainment in St. Louis. We've known each other for a long time. He reviews movies at Dose of Buffa, but he's also written some blog posts recently about Dolly Parton and some other things, so we'll hook up with Dan. He's always a fun conversation. We'll do that one on the Zoom. We have one right now. By the way, we're doing this a little bit more. There's this new invention called video, and we can actually talk to someone and see them at the same time. It's amazing. They've kind of walked me into this week here at 97.1 FM Talk. So if you're watching on the YouTube feed or on the X, formerly Twitter, you can actually see me. And, for example, my next guest, who is Jonathan Dickinson, CEO and co-founder of Ambio Life Sciences. He is a leading expert on Ibogaine, and he's got a new book out called Ibogaine and the Bicameral Mind. Jonathan Dickinson, welcome to 97.1 FM Talk in St. Louis. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So last summer, I think it was last summer, I'm driving into work and I'm listening to Fox, and they're doing an interview with the former governor of Texas, Rick Perry. And this may have been 2 years ago. You know, time goes by quickly. And he's talking about Ibogaine. I'd never heard of Ibogaine before. He was referring to a piece that he had written in the Washington Post. I was absolutely dazzled by the story that he was telling. I then, in turn, got someone on the air right away who was involved in this effort. And I'm someone here in St. Louis who certainly supports what this substance drug is all about. But, Jonathan, I'm guessing most of my listeners, despite covering this a couple of times on the show, they have no idea what it is. So maybe let's start here with what Ibogaine is and in your connection to this whole movement.
Sure. So Ibogaine is a very strong psychoactive. It comes from an African plant called Iboga and has been used in Gabon for centuries, probably for millennia, in rituals of healing and rites of passage. And then in the last couple hundred years, Ibogaine has been extracted from Iboga and it's found a couple of different medical uses. So the most notable of those is it has this capacity to mitigate withdrawal from opiates. And so it wasn't approved for that in the United States and was prohibited, but clinics popped up in Mexico as more and more people were benefiting from it and wanted to go experience that. And it's only in the last couple of years that we've started to have this opportunity to work with more veterans who have traumatic brain injuries and to really understand a lot more what's happening when people take Ibogaine. So it's a strong psychoactive, but it has these incredible and really lasting healing capabilities that we don't really know of any other pharmaceutical that has something similar.
So what is your connection to this? Do you have a direct connection or is it just something that became a passion? How did that come about?
I experienced healing from psychedelics when I was young. I had a really difficult time withdrawing from antidepressants that I was put on when I was a young man. And so I became really fascinated by it. And Ibogaine was a clinical context for these substances. There was a model forming in Mexico around the sort of community of people who had, you know, found benefit themselves and then turned around to gradually build on the medical model of care that we have today. So based on my own experience, I got involved and have done a bunch of work in the community to help develop safety standards that have improved the our capacity to mitigate some of the medical risks of taking it.
I think and a now, lot. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish. Close your loop there. I'm sorry.
Sure. Just now I'm helping one of the co-founders of Ambio Life Sciences, which is one of the largest clinics in the world. So we treat several thousand people every year who are coming down both to Mexico and Malta for various reasons to receive Ibogaine.
So a lot of people, I think, might be familiar with the story of Marcus Luttrell, the sole survivor of the Taliban ambush in Afghanistan. This goes back 21 years ago, 2005, and there was a book and a movie, Lone Survivor. Governor Perry became very close with Marcus Luttrell, and when he wrote about this in the Washington Post, he specifically wrote about Marcus Luttrell and his brother, who had experienced, you know, a lot of pain and PTSD, but also had gone down to experience Ibogaine, and he saw a complete reversal. And then I think, and you would know more about this than I did, but Rick Perry himself has undergone this treatment, right?
Yeah, he's been open about that fact. And, I think he was expressing that while he saw some of these war fighters who had obvious exposure to minor traumatic brain injury, that he himself went and got brain scans before and after. Maybe he had some sports-related concussions. He wasn't a professional or so like heavily involved in that, but he said that his neurologist also noticed benefits just in terms of his general age. And so, yeah, so I know that he's been very vocal about it. And to be honest, it's amazing to me to see the energy that's happening in the United States and with the federal government. And I think Rick Perry's been a big part of helping to translate that story.
Absolutely. I think he has. And I'm glad that he's shining light on this for sure. Jonathan Dickinson is here. We're talking about Ibogaine. He's written a book called Ibogaine and the Bicameral Mind. So there was a great piece in the Free Press from the spring by a guy by the name of Josh Code. You probably saw this because he told the story of a guy named Chase Rowan who used to jump out of planes for a living. And he was an Army Ranger at the age of 21. He used to parachute behind enemy lines to kill insurgent fighters. So he was on combat tours, multiple. His first one was 2005. He gets back after 150 combat missions, and his body's beaten up and his mind is beaten up as well. He's got a lot of headaches. He struggles to keep his balance while standing or walking. He's ready to kill himself. He prepares to end his life. And then he's actually sitting on his couch behind some suicide notes, watching some music videos, planning on, killing himself the next day. And he sees something on video from the Joe Rogan Experience. And Rogan was interviewing U.S. Marine Dakota Meyer, who was a Medal of Honor recipient, saved 36 lives in Afghanistan, had a lot of PTSD, and underwent Ibogaine. And up until this point, Mr. Rowan had never heard of Ibogaine. It literally, that conversation saved his life, didn't it?
I mean, that's a sentiment that we hear way too often. I mean, it's a sign of how deeply guys are struggling when they're coming back from war, but partly, as you mentioned, with the emotional toll, but also with the physical toll. So the signature wound of the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan is minor traumatic brain injury, which happens from being exposed to, repeatedly to blasts or to high caliber weapon fire that's moving your head around and pressing, the soft brain tissue against the hard, skull and causing a cumulative damage. And so what's amazing is, what you described includes not only are guys struggling sort of emotionally, but you described neurological symptoms, headaches and loss of balance and things like that. And it's even with these types of things that guys are sort of experiencing a sense of relief that we don't really know of anything else that does that. So that's a sentiment that we hear fairly often.
Is there a way that you can describe how it works? And because this is a very, and I've covered this before, and I think, Jonathan, this is important. This is a very, very powerful substance, right? I mean, this has to be, when it is a procedure, it has to be extremely medically supervised, correct?
Yeah, I mean, anything that has this effect on the body that's that systemic and it's touching so many things is bound to have risk. And from that perspective, Ibogaine is very safe. Unfortunately, though, over the years, people in extreme states of health have at some times had to be hospitalized, and there's been a series of fatalities that have happened. It's a very small overall number, and we've learned a great deal about what happened and how to mitigate those risks. But it is really important to have the medical context around the treatment to be able to screen people out or provide the monitoring that's necessary to make it safe.
How is Ibogaine different than some of the other things? Like Aaron Rodgers went through an experience with psychedelics, and other people have talked about some of these other substances. How is it different from that?
Well, one of the things that's very different about it is just the depth and intensity that it takes you to. And one of the ways that that occurs in the body, we call this critical period of neuroplasticity that opens up afterwards. And that's the brain's ability to be able to change, basically. So this would be helpful even just to allow the body's natural healing processes to unfold, without being impeded by damage or whatever. So the critical period that ibogaine opens up after a single dose is far and away greater than other psychedelics that we see. So there was one study that showed, ketamine lasted several days, this period of neuroplasticity, psilocybin and MDMA 2 weeks, LSD 3 weeks. Ibogaine hadn't even started to plateau and drop off by the time they had to stop measuring for the study after a month. So we know from watching people that this period is months long. And there's
Ambiel,
nothing that does anything like that.
yeah, Ambiel Life Sciences is based in Tijuana, right? You can't do this in America yet.
That's right. We have sites in Mexico, in Tijuana, Mexico, as well as in Malta. But yeah, in the United States, ibogaine is a Schedule One narcotic.
But there are efforts, and this is one of the things that Rick Perry talked about. There's an investment from the state of Texas to look into this further. And President Trump is actually behind this because he signed an executive order that is going to offer federal assistance for research on ibogaine as well, right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, there's a huge amount of interest that's forming, especially now that ARPA-H has is currently looking at prospects to receive a $50 million grant. And so that sort of matches what Texas put on the table. But it seems like there's other funds coming down the pipe. And so there's certainly enough energy here. And hopefully there's the willingness. I mean, ibogaine is a atypical kind of treatment. And so there's going to have to be some adaptation in the clinical trial process and the healthcare system to make sure that we're both evaluating this in the right way, but also accommodating for just how different it is.
What do you, and I know you covered this a little bit, but when it comes to what ibogaine has the potential to unlock or to cure, we talked about the PTSD, but there's also aspects of anxiety, depression, and you mentioned addiction as well, right? So it seems to cover a lot of ground.
Sure. So, I mean, still, I still feel that its ability to mitigate withdrawals from opiates is so impressive. Like, there's nothing that does anything like that. But what we're seeing neurologically is not only people with these like minor traumatic brain injuries from combat or from sports, but even people who have more advanced neurodegenerative conditions like Parkinson's and MS and ALS and who have suffered from stroke are also seeing these regenerative benefits that, again, there's no other option for them on the table that offers that. Unfortunately, we still don't know very much about how ibogaine works. We have really interesting signals. What we do know is that it's multi-system. It's touching a lot of different parts of our pharmacology and seems to be doing something rather fundamental to improving the function of cells, and so in neurons in particular. And so that's why perhaps it seems to be addressing many different things in different ways.
But this is something that these things take a while, right? I mean, for this to eventually have an application in the US, would there be a timetable that you would even envision there or not?
Typically, something like this would take 10 years or more.
Right.
What is incredible right now is just the willingness that we see in the federal government. Like the situation is atypical in many regards, but one of them is the fact that, here's this promise that's being shown through real-world evidence, even though it's something that's not already approved. And so normally you don't have that for an investigational drug, and there's something about that that needs to be taken into consideration. So it may help the FDA to warm up to sort of accelerating through some of the safety trials and things like that. It remains to be seen, but if there's enough willingness, the timeline can be shortened. And one of the things that the executive order did was to provide a provision for a right to try, which would mean that even during its evaluation through clinical trials, it could be available to a small number of people inside the United States who qualify through that program.
It's interesting and certainly opening up a whole new world, but the research is important because, as you said, you don't really even know exactly how it works in some of the things that are a result of this. But it's fascinating when you hear the firsthand accounts, and even Governor Perry's firsthand account is really amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. It sort of becomes the norm for us day in and day out, and we hope that it is able to bring hope to corners of medicine and to people who, are facing situations where there aren't really other options available for them, and maybe this is a glimmer of hope.
Jonathan, is your book out right now? It's called Ibogaine and the Bicameral Mind. Is it out?
It's going to be out in a couple of days. It comes out September 8th, but you can pre-order it everywhere that you normally buy books. And it tries to unpack a little bit more about the experience that people go through. Because as amazing as it is that it has these medical benefits and these neurological benefits, it is a journey to go through.
There's a
And
spiritual aspect, isn't there, to a certain extent? That's what people describe.
absolutely. I mean, as much as we see people coming down and sort of their cognitive function improve and sometimes their motor function improve, we also see improvements in relationships, and a lot of guys just, rediscover faith in their lives where that had been lost as well. And so, yeah, it's very complex the way that it fits into a life and helps to support healing.
Well, I'm a supporter, certainly, of the research and moving forward to see what the options and the benefits can be. Jonathan Dickinson, again, the book is called Ibogaine and the Bicameral Mind. Keep me posted on the progress with all this because I'm someone here in Missouri that's an advocate and, has tried to get some of my thoughts to the people and the powers that be. But we have some members of the legislature here that are open to this as well. So I think we can move forward with progress in our state. But Jonathan, thanks so much for coming on, and you have a great Labor Day weekend. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, we have a bit of a legal mess here in Missouri with congressional districts. This story broke yesterday, and we had AG Hanaway on right away. Look, what I said on the roundtable a couple of hours ago, and for those people who aren't caught up here, the Supreme Court, and they did this unanimously, by the way, blocked the new maps that were written by the legislature from being used in the November election. They ordered a couple of things, a statewide vote on whether to uphold or reject the new map, and we're going back to the old maps. Now, the problem with that is, and I tried to point this out, I mean, no matter what side you might be on here on this particular issue, one thing should be indisputable, that there were people who voted in the primary who are definitely disenfranchised voters because they now will not have that same opportunity to vote for the same candidate or the same congressional district. So going back to the AG, she's appealing. She's trying to take this to the Supreme Court. The Missouri Supreme Court already denied something in their appeal, so now it goes to the Supremes.
This is truly unprecedented. It's unbelievable. No court in the country has ever ordered a change in congressional maps between a primary and general election. We will be applying to the U.S. Supreme Court for a stay. You will have people voting in a different congressional district in the general election than they voted in the primary. And the outcomes of those primaries may well have been different.
Yeah, you have like State Senator Rick Bratton, who won a few weeks ago in the 5th Congressional District. And that's been, stretched to include rural Republican areas. About 59% of those voters were under the new map. And Emmanuel Cleaver, in one of the reports I have from the Associated Press, actually, this might be from Newsmax, believe it or not, it says Cleaver had not posted campaign signs in many of the new rural areas, explaining he was waiting for the Supreme Court's decision, but it vowed to continue his reelection campaign regardless of the outcome. So what happens if the Supreme Court does not get involved here? Here's Mike Kehoe, the governor, on Fox this morning.
What I'm wrestling with is 5 of the 7 justices appointed to the Missouri Supreme Court are Republicans. How did this happen?
Yeah, well, good morning, Lawrence. It's actually unprecedented. We never thought we would come to a point where Missourians, to your point, just 1 month ago today, over 1.2 million Missourians voted on maps that were in front of them. And the courts have now pulled that from under them and said, no, you're not voting on that map. You're going to vote on a different map in November. It astounded everybody. It's literally, I think the President Trump described it exactly right. It's incredible. Our Attorney General, Catherine Hanaway, has done a great job. She's going to go right to the Supreme Court, as you know, and Missourians should have a chance to vote for the candidates on the maps that they just voted on 30 days ago today.
One of the things I said during the roundtable is, I mean, if I'm a voter in the 5th District who voted for Rick Bratton and now I can't vote for Rick Bratton, I'm disenfranchised. Wouldn't I file a lawsuit too? Or could a group of voters file a lawsuit? Governor Kehoe says he's going to fight this, obviously.
Before I get to the Supreme Court, because that's where it's going to end, the DNC rightfully are celebrating this. They said this is a big win for democracy and the people of Missouri. Democrats will continue to fight to end the Republican gerrymandering sham and ensure all voters can make their voices heard. What is your response to that? Because they feel like they have the wind in their sails now.
Well, I guess they would be celebrating because we literally just stole away from Missourians the right to vote on the mass that they were put in front of all summer long. Candidates campaign for these districts. It affects more than just one district, as you know. Just about a year ago today, the Missouri legislature met to make sure we don't have a gerrymandered map, that we do have districts that are compact and contiguous. And that's what the map is in front of them. The Missouri First map is the map of the land in the state of Missouri. And the Missouri Supreme Court just said, voters, nah, we think we're better than you are. We're going to go ahead and change this back.
So now you have to have the Supreme Court rule on this. And I think conventional wisdom is they're maybe going to kick it back and say, this is your problem, Missouri. So it is a mess. And I'm not sure how we get out of it. You know, we talk entertainment on Fridays in the 4 o'clock hour with Paul Hall from Common Guy Films. And every once in a while, I have my friend Dan Buffa pinch hit. But I've missed him so much, I thought, you know what, Dan, let's do a separate segment outside of that and have you on at 5:30 on 97.1 FM Talk. How are you?
This is a perfect way to end a long, hot week of working in a plumbing warehouse. So this is like the banana split at the end of a long week.
I
so
love
I'll take it.
I love it. Well, we're Dan and I are friends. We love to talk entertainment. He is a fellow movie critic. I've kind of semi-retired from seeing movies on a regular basis. And, dude, I don't know if we've really talked about this, but, like, I seem to be the outlier on every film. Like, I thought The Odyssey was okay. You know, I wasn't blown away by it. I don't think I need to see it again. I loved Project Hail Mary. That probably was my favorite film of the year so far. I thought Spider-Man was average. I seem to be on the outlier end of that because everyone loved it. It's now made like $900 million domestically. Where were you on Spider-Man and The Odyssey?
I really enjoyed Spider-Man just because of course, they brought John Bernthal in, and that always makes everything better. And I just thought that the story was a little more cohesive than No Way Home, but everybody liked No Way Home, and I just thought it was kind of okay. But the inclusion of Bernthal and kind of a little bit of a different thing with Tom Holland, I also just think he's a joy to watch as Spider-Man. He kind of nails both roles pretty well, and it's not easy, but he's also insanely likable. But The Odyssey, I was crazy about.
You
and
were.
I did watch twice.
Okay. Let me go back to Spider-Man real quick. I love Tom Holland in the role. I really do. And I've loved all the movies. And I didn't think this was a bad movie. I just was surprised that the reaction was more positive than I thought it should have been. And, man, it's making a lot of money. With The Odyssey, I made sure, Dan, that I saw it on the IMAX. I was actually going to go to the screening. I think it was on a Monday night. But it was the night of the Home Run Derby, as you might remember. And I think I made a good call to not go to the critic screening because of what happened with Jordan Walker. So I went into it with, you know, certainly open mind. And I love Chris Nolan. And, you know, everything about the cast seemed fine. I know that there was some stuff about it being woke with Elliot Page, etc. But that didn't really bother me. That was a small portion of it. I just thought it was loud. I couldn't understand the dialogue at times. I mean, Matt Damon was fighting a lot of stuff on the water, but outside that, it did not emotionally connect with me in any way, shape, or form. So from that perspective, I think Chris Nolan's movies in the past were a lot better than this film, but it's probably going to win every damn award it's nominated for in the winter, right?
It's definitely going to contend. I don't love all of his movies. I wasn't in Interstellar.
We're losing you here, unfortunately. Hang on, Dan. Hang on. We got technical. As soon as I start bragging about the video connections that we have and doing stuff like that, then it breaks up and I can't hear you. Are you there? Are you there right now? Yeah. Sorry about that. You cut out for a second.
I can hear you.
But I think I missed what you were saying there.
Christopher Nolan did that, man. I don't think he liked the way you're talking.
Yeah. Well, what was the film? You were saying something about Chris Nolan's movie that you didn't like that other people liked. Which one was it?
Interstellar. Okay. Everybody's crazy about. I just kind of think it's okay. And Tenet, I think I didn't really know what he was going for. But so this one, I thought he kind of really got back to his Inception roots, the way he kind of makes a film about a guy who is desperately just trying to get home to his family. But I also thought the cast that he brought along, Tom Holland, you really wanted to strangle Robert Pattinson. I mean, the whole cast really brought it, and it's a beautiful film. And I watched it twice just to make sure that I wasn't just, you know, sometimes you see a film for the first time and you kind of fall hard, but I wasn't expecting to love it as much as I did. But yeah, I'm kind of in the majority on that. It's almost kind of boring, Mark. You're in the minority.
I am in the minority.
Spot to be.
I can't believe that I'm in the minority on some of these things. I really can't. All right, how about anything streaming wise? Are you watching anything right now that has caught your attention? I've been doing a lot of the documentaries that are on Netflix. I'm actually watching Tehran on Apple TV Plus. We're in the middle of the second season. I never really watched that until about a month ago. I think it's pretty entertaining. Apple TV Plus has a lot of really good quality shows that I think have been excellent. But are you streaming anything?
They do have a lot of good content.
What are you streaming that you would recommend these days?
I just finished up Furious with Emmy Rossum, and it's a show, kind of a serial killer, not more of a whodunit, more of a cat and mouse. We know who is the killer in the first episode, but it's the return of Emmy Rossum to a full-fledged leading role in a TV show that does this one much better. It's 8 episodes. It just finished up. And this is a kind of show where the antagonist and the protagonist, they share scenes together because they have something in common. And it shines a non-preachy light on the long-term effects of sexual abuse and how that can make somebody turn one way and maybe make some other person turn towards like the other way, as in law enforcement. But they have a shared experience. And so I think with being entertaining, it also says a lot about a topic that maybe not a lot of filmmakers or TV showrunners can make.
And that one is called, and where is it streaming?
It is streaming on Furious. It is not Fast and the Furious. There is no Vin Diesel here. It is just Furious on Hulu. Just finished up on Sunday. 8 episodes. They don't waste a second of your time. There is no filler episodes where you're kind of like, well, that wasn't necessary.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole cast, I mean, Scoot McNairy, who you'll know from 17 different movies, he has a really good role in it. But it's Emmy's show, man. She's a powerhouse in this one.
Well, look, I love her. And of course, I think most people would know her from the show Shameless. She was fantastic in that. That show lost its way, I think, in the last couple of seasons. I'm not even sure she was in it for the last season. But I've always liked her as an actress. But what's funny about, you're the first person that's brought this show to my attention, Furious. And I'm about to go, I probably maybe would have seen it because I'm a Chad Powers fan. And season 2 of that just got released. So I'm going to Hulu this weekend to at least watch a little Chad Powers.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good gems. I think they even put 9 to 5. Dolly Parton.
They did.
They put that, which is smart because we all need a little bit of Dolly this week, don't we?
Well, you know what, Dan? I'm going to talk to you about that because I know you wrote a little bit on your blog about Dolly, and even maybe you said something about your dad being a little confused while you were sad about Dolly Parton. You made a little bit of an analogy, but that didn't really affect, you know, when that happened, it's unusual, as you know, because there's so much division pretty much on everything these days. No better example than what happened in the news today with this Lindsay Clancy trial, but everybody loves Dolly, right? And everybody loved Dolly, and there's so many tributes out there. It's pretty awesome to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I think that when celebrities die, we all kind of get hit a little bit. But for somebody who tried to do as much with her name without ever really talking down to people with it, she was just such a pro, very easygoing, and she used her time really well. It makes me want to kind of use my time a little more well before I finally jump off this rock.
Well, because what I said, and I tweeted this at the time, I never really remember Dolly not smiling. And even if she was saying something kind of, you know, business-wise that was sharp or was trying to make a point, she still did it with her smile and with her giggle. And she really was a complete cultural phenomenon. There's no doubt about that.
I mean, even in Steel Magnolias, when she's putting down Shirley MacLaine, she does it with kind of a smile while she's doing hair. That's just what she could do. She could never be mean. And I think, but she could say something, you know, instructive or kind of feedback, but she never gave off a non-positive vibe. And I think that's so hard for anybody to do, like you or me or somebody in her status, to kind of never give off a vibe that wasn't like, man, this is fun. She had fun being Dolly.
I think it's very difficult for people to do that. And you're right. She was excellent at it. One of the shows that I talked about with Paul Hall in the last hour, I've been seeing a lot of the promos for it. Have you checked out Mayday, which is the new show that's with Ryan Reynolds on Apple TV Plus?
Is it a movie or is it a show?
It's a movie. I'm sorry. It's a movie. It is a movie.
Like, oh, man, 8 episodes. Oh, no.
No. That one is a movie. You're right.
It looks like a perfect pairing. You got a guy like Reynolds who looks to be doing Ryan Reynolds kind of his usual thing. But then you have Kenneth Branagh, you know, kind of using almost getting comic relief to the comic relief. So I'm very, it reminds me of Man from U.N.C.L.E. when you had Cavill and Hammer kind of paired with each other. You have Reynolds and this guy and this very esteemed, serious Shakespearean actor. So I think it looks good. I have not watched it yet, but I now it is back on my radar.
So the show that I'm most looking forward to, and I hope it's not disappointing, and I do like a lot of the shows and the offerings on Apple TV+. Have you seen the trailer for Brothers? This is Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. They play themselves in this particular series. It debuts on Wednesday, September 23rd on Apple TV+. The trailer makes it look amazing. And these two guys, again, talk about likability factor. They're just a lot of fun. So I'm looking forward to that one.
Fun fact, Mark, and I can't really discuss too much of it. I've watched the whole show.
Have you?
I'll just say this. It's the Ed TV sequel we all wanted that we never got, to have these two guys who there is, like you said, there's a rumor that they could be related, but right. In this one, they take the personas and they just kind of investigate that while giving us Woody and Matt. So I will say, I don't really care at this point. It's a lot of fun. A lot of fun. It's 8 episodes. They go by quick. They're like 25 minutes to 30 minutes apiece, but it's the Ed TV sequel that we all wanted.
I love it. I'm looking forward to it. And again, I really do like Apple TV Plus. I don't know if you were a fan of your friends.
They're very unique, yeah.
I love Your Friends and Neighbors. I think both of those seasons, that's the John Hamm show, was outstanding.
So I think for people that want to see a different side of Tom Holland, watch the Apple original Cherry, where he plays an Army war veteran who comes home and starts robbing banks with his girlfriends. It was his girlfriend. It's by the Russo brothers.
Yeah.
And it's a very serious, almost Platoon-like serious movie where we get to see a different side of Tom Holland that we don't get to see. He's more of an anti-hero instead of a hero. So Cherry on Apple TV+, they have so much good content on there.
Are you a Slow Horses fan?
I have watched the first season, so I am way behind, but they pump those seasons out, Mark, like no other. I mean, Gary Oldman must just be living and breathing that character.
I have never seen, for a show called Slow Horses, the great irony is, you're right, they rock these seasons out. They usually have trailers for the next season by the time the last season ends, and I think it might be season six now. We're on season six that's going to come out here on the 16th of September, so that's crazy. It's pretty good. It's entertaining. I like Slow Horses. You should catch up, because Jack Loudon, who plays River Cartwright, is really good in that movie with Gary Oldman. And Gary Oldman is just a classic, you know, grouchy character. It's really good. Dan Buffett, it's awesome to hook up with you. Dose of Buffett. Tell folks where they can find what you write about and talk about entertainment-wise. I think you blocked out again. Dan, are you there? Well, it's Dose of Buffett. Just Google that. That's Dan Buffett. We're coming back with Audio Cut of the Day. I have a good one here today, too. Unfortunately, it's about the Lisa Clancy case, but some of that coming up here. Well, we will not be here Monday, but we'll kind of be here Monday. Ethan's put together a great best of show, including my conversation from a couple of weeks ago that I had with both Mayor Spencer, Robert Tracy, the police chief, and Chris Saraceno from the police board. They were two separate interviews, but we have kind of cobbled them together for one of the hours. We do a fun segment here called The Price is Wrong with the guy who's the voice on The Price is Right, George Gray, who has St. Louis connections. His mom, Mama May, lives here. And we had a great one in July when George was last year. He's actually working for a living. He doesn't do that much because they don't tape year-round, but they're taping in Hollywood right now. I just actually texted him last week. He's coming back into town in a few weeks, but we have a great one episode that we did with George Gray from July that will air on Monday afternoon. So unfortunately, kind of a bummer for Audio Cut of the Day, but let's get to it.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the Audio Cut of the Day.
Well, the Lindsay Clancy trial went to a mistrial officially. It was officially declared after the jury, and it was just one juror could not come to an agreement with the other 11.
Members of the jury, at this point, I'm going to declare that the jury is deadlocked, and I'm going to declare a mistrial. I understood that you all gave everything you could, and probably more than you thought you could. And so on behalf of myself, I just want to thank you so much.
You know, these jurors have been through 7 weeks of hell, seeing, you know, crime scene photographs that are just horrific, hearing the description of these young kids who should be remembered more than anyone else, more than Kevin Reddington, more than Tim Cruise, the DA, more than Judge Sullivan. It's Cora, Dawson, and Callan, who were just, you know, violently strangled to death. Now, I am empathetic to mental illness issues because I've gone through them myself. But, you know, it seems as if this is somebody, look, it's so divided. You got people out there that think you're letting a murderer go free. Other people out there think you did the wrong thing because of the mental illness. Listen to the people in the courtroom. This is Lauren Callan, who's one of the reporters in the courtroom.
They were very tense. They were very seemingly upset. I mean, the judge was praising them. He was telling them they did an incredible job and he understood how tough it was. But no, they weren't satisfied as they spent 38 hours and 7 days deliberating. And I can see how frustrating it would be for some of them when there's one person holding out.
So there were 9 women on the jury, 3 men. There were 18 impaneled overall. You had alternates. But Lauren Collins said it was pretty obvious, and this is how I think Kevin Reddington knew who the juror was who was the holdout. They can kind of identify him throughout the last few weeks.
Ooh, I want to be careful because I do think I have an idea of maybe who the juror was, and I had observed this juror pretty frequently, and I thought maybe this person wasn't taking enough notes, or he wasn't taking enough notes as compared to the other jurors. And look, I said he, but Kevin Reddington also identified this juror as a man, so I'm not saying anything I shouldn't supposed to, or I'm not supposed to, but yes, I did observe a little bit, and I think I can identify who it was.
So in one quarter or portion or half of social media or the landscape, you have people declaring that holdout juror a hero, right? Kevin Reddington, the Lindsey Clancy supporters, think that he did the absolute wrong thing. Listen to this absolute call out, which I think is ethically inappropriate, of that juror.
Why do you think it went this way, you know, with that one juror fighting this mistrial?
I don't know. I don't know the man. I don't know what his background, his feelings are. I don't know. I mean, our jury system, we like to say that people have a right to have their opinions and stand by their beliefs. I don't have a problem with that. I do have a problem where 11 hardworking jurors, after all of those days of deliberation and a 7-week trial, say that this man had doubt, but still would not apply the law.
So Kevin Reddington in that soundbite is a little bit more diplomatic than this one.
They know that they were robbed by one man for whatever his agenda was, who stole 7 weeks of the life of these other jurors that were so attentive, so beautiful, so wonderful, and listened to this evidence. And you could see how defeated they were sitting there. And I got a funny feeling that they would have gone on for another week if they had to. So I hope that guy can sleep well at night.
So Jonathan Turley had a harsh reaction to that, but I did want to play one more cut here from, this is a CNN reporter that was in the courtroom kind of reacting to the female jurors.
When the judge said, "I want to tell you all how proud I am of you," there was one female juror that was nodding her head no as he was saying all that. Another female juror clenching her hands into fists as she was sitting on that chair. All of the jurors were extremely tense. One female juror would not even open her eyes.
So if you're Tim Cruise, who's the DA, or the ADA, Jennifer Sprague, in this case, do you retry it? They seemingly had always wanted to. If you heard Kevin Reddington this week, he said, oh yeah, they're going to retry it no matter what happens. Here's DA Tim Cruise earlier.
Our priority has always been to fight for Cora, for Dawson, and for Callan. The noise in this case may be louder than it is for other prosecutions in our county, but we have treated it the same as any other case. Children were murdered, and it's our job to seek justice.
In a horrific, horrific way. And what's happening in this country right now is just bizarre, as he points out. Criminals are being seen as the victims.
But also speaking in the world that we live today, and all too often, criminals are being treated as victims, and the real victims are invisible. It is our job to make sure that the victims are not invisible, to make sure that they're not forgotten, and to make sure that we stand for them in the way that we seek justice. And that's what I think we've done in this case. And I cannot imagine the hell this entire family has lived through. I remind myself that this is and has been and always will be about getting justice and making sure that we do not forget Cora, Dawson, or Little Cal.
So, look, I think the best solution moving forward, especially if you're the DA, if you're Tim Cruz, and you see that you almost lost this case. I mean, you came within one juror being stubborn of losing this case and, you know, probably guilty by reason of insanity. It would probably behoove everyone to cut a deal at this point and make sure that Lindsey Clancy is in a facility where she cannot harm other people for a long, long time. But to put everyone through, you know, the horror of this trial again for weeks on end, I'm not sure that's the best move moving forward. I hope the DA kind of sees it that way as well. And we're going to take a break here. We'll come back on Tuesday afternoon. Sue's gone until Thursday, unfortunately. Have a great Labor Day weekend. Enjoy all the college football, the baseball. Hopefully the Cardinals get back on track tonight in Colorado. We got a best of show on Monday afternoon. Have a great weekend.
Get more at 971talk.com.